You know, there's a famous story about Calvin Coolidge, who was famously non-loquacious or laconic, either one. And he went to church and came back, and his wife said, "What did the preacher talk about? Sin? What did he say? Against it?" The bad news today is I'm talking about the Bible. Good news is today I'm talking about sex. So I'll try to make it worth your while. The subject of driving the snakes away. And snakes have a very interesting, I hope you find, role in scriptures. You all know about the snake in Eden, the temptation that the snake offers. It was an interesting snake because before it seduced Adam and Eve, it had legs. So it was actually, biblically, in Genesis, there was a legged snake. Is the Bible trying to tell us that evolution takes place? That over a period of some time, the snake lost its legs? Could this help explain what happened with whales? Maybe whales lost their legs through some kind of terrible sin, and leading humanity astray somewhere, or having a whale of a time about something or other, although it may be a different context. The snake in the Garden of Eden, it seemed clear even before Freud, was talking about temptation of possibly a sexual nature. Snakes show up again in the Exodus story where Moses tries to intimidate Pharaoh with his staff, and then the staff turns into a snake and freaks out Pharaoh. And then he goes, Moses, to the Red Sea and parts the Red Sea by raising up his staff. The Red Sea is a symbol, not so just a miracle story, but if you understand, as we'll go over in some detail at our Passover Seder, that the Red Sea story is a birth story, that the Hebrew people are living in slavery and in darkness, not really truly alive when you're a slave and in darkness, living in the west where the sun sets. And they are reborn into a new life on the desert. They are reborn through a wet channel, a canal. Now, lest you think that I am post facto reading in Freudian symbolism, you really have to understand that the people that wrote and edited the Bible were as bright as we are. They understood symbolism and they understood metaphor, and it's put together with tremendous sense of intentionality and the use of images. And the idea of from darkness to light being a birth story seems really clear when you look at what happens after the birth story. The first thing that the people do is they get fed. They don't have to take care of themselves, just like a child. The next thing they do is they rebel and question the values that they have been given, and just like an adolescent. And the next thing that they do is they grow up, they get married, they move on in their lives till they come to another river and their children can cross into that river. It is a birth and a rebirth story, and you figure out the potent image of raising that staff in order to facilitate the conception, the birth, the rebirth of the people. Snakes show up in the gospel story. In Mark 16:18, Mark says that the faithful will be able to handle snakes and not die. A lot of fundamentalists, having taken that literally, met the Lord earlier than otherwise planned. Whether this was some defect in faith or defect in their interpretation of scriptures, I don't know, but it certainly had some, I think, biblically unintended consequences of people playing with snakes. To put all, well, let me tell you one more phallic image. Here's the deal. Religion, every religion, to some extent or another, theologians talk wonderful high concepts about theology and the nature of God. Politicians, kings, priests talk about how to keep people in order and laws and rules. But religion, when you look at what every religion shares, it isn't necessarily a theology or even the same mythology. It shares being about, at some level, fertility. And fertility of the crops, fertility of the earth, fertility of the people. And that almost always necessitates sex. And religion is stuck with a couple of really difficult conundrums, and that is almost every religion historically, classically, has wanted to encourage conception and the birth of children, because children were always considered wealth. They were considered our old age insurance. You increased your wealth by having more and more children. This was true up until the invention of something called college. And the junior year abroad program, which was really the deal buster on this, and the value of children, at least numerically, is changing, although some religions are slow to figure this out. But religions were stuck trying to encourage conception and discourage and control sex. And that's a problem, because they are usually related somehow. And the thing about most of the religions is they wanted to control this because you have issues of property, you have issues of inheritance, you have issues of whose line, family line, is going to continue and what values are going to be exemplified by how people deal with sex and sexuality. The Bible is very strongly against romance and, to some extent, love. The Bible takes a stand that romance and lust and love, and it tends to mix those together, are disturbing to society. They get in the way of people making good, solid choices and obeying their obligations and their duty to family and to tribe and to people. And almost as soon as religion starts, you start seeing the issues of God opening and closing wombs, God blessing people with children. Abram, you'll all remember from the book, before he became Abraham, was 98 years old. And God said to him, I want you to have a baby with your wife Sarai, who became Sarah. And all you have to do is go outside the camp and with a sharp stone, circumcise yourself. He was 98 years old at the time, and you thought you had a bad HMO. God's HMO is certainly the worst HMO I've ever heard of. So they did. They did that, and they had their child, Isaac. And then the first romance in the Bible takes place when Isaac's son. Well, let me go back a second. Isaac marries Rebekah, and he's told to marry Rebekah, and Rebekah's told to marry Isaac, and Rebekah says, cool, Dad, whatever you tell me, I'll go do. Rebecca's a good girl. But their son, Jacob, after a lot of dirty tricks with his father and his brother, goes off to his uncle's place and he sees this girl. And he is struck by the thunderbolt. And he's in love. And he runs up to Rachel. And he embraces her and he kisses her. So he goes to the man who's going to become his father-in-law, and he says, I'd really like to marry Rachel. And the father-in-law says, that's nice. Just cool your heels and work really hard for me for 7 years, and then you can have Rachel. But on the wedding night, he slips, instead of Rachel, Leah into the marriage tent. And Jacob wakes up the next morning and goes, oi, somebody here has made a mistake. I wanted Rachel the beauty. I got Leah the Mizkite, which is homely. And he goes to his father-in-law and says, Dad, this is kind of bait and switch, isn't it? And his dad says, his father-in-law says, well, you know, you can't marry the younger sister before the older sister. These things just aren't done. The values of the tribe... don't let your passion and your love and your lust invalidate our ways, which need to be orderly and businesslike. As Tevye said, the people arranging their own marriage, unheard of, uncalled for. How can this be? And so Rachel is, he gets to have Rachel after another week, but and has to work another 7 years, but Rachel is cursed for this by being barren until after much wailing, different kind of wailing from the whales that have legs. After much wailing, she finally conceives Joseph. And then she dies in childbirth, giving birth to Benjamin, and she's buried in Bethlehem, the first biblical mention of Bethlehem. So then the story moves on, and you have the story of Dinah. And Dinah is walking around Shechem, and the prince of Shechem and she get together. The Bible's unclear exactly how that's facilitated, but she wanted to marry him, and he wanted to marry her, and so they did, and so all of them were slaughtered. And they were slaughtered because you don't arrange your own marriage by love, by romance, by passion. Those are messy and disorderly. It's very strange. The Bible doesn't necessarily disapprove of sex, only of love. Does that seem religiously upside down and backwards to today? It seems a little ironic to me. When you go through all of scriptures, you see these kinds of tensions going on. When you go to the gospel stories, and you see that... Paul, well, not in the Gospels, but Paul tells people, you know, it's really better not to lust at all. And Jesus says in the Gospels, you know, if you lusting is just really as bad as doing it, I think that there's a context that we can talk about that's not the intent of the passage. But some people take that as the intent of the passage. And throughout Scriptures, there is this ambivalence. In the Gospels and in all of the New Testament, you have a sense of the body being filled with lust and impure, and the spirit and the soul being pure and otherworldly. That's why Mary is a virgin perpetually in Catholicism and a virgin at the conception of Jesus in Protestantism, because somehow sex is just kind of messy. One more story to tie them together. There's a very interesting story in the Hebrew Scriptures that leads into the gospel narrative, and that's the story of Judah. And Judah has a son, and Judah has a daughter-in-law, Tamar. And the son dies. And Tamar says, well, you know, I am your daughter-in-law, even if your son died, and so I need to be made pregnant in order for your son's line to continue. So Judah says to his other son, Onan, you've all heard of Onan, makes a generator for those of you who have RVs. It's a little esoteric, but some of you got that. Onan is ordered to impregnate his sister-in-law, and... He doesn't want his seed not to be his seed, because the child would not be his. It was to continue his brother's line, and he said, why should I work even pleasurably to continue my brother's line? So he left her unfulfilled and spilled his seed, for which he was killed by God. I mean, God's not only tough as HMO, but in the penalty phase, he's tough also. So Onan is killed, and Tamar is still left, I think we can say, unfulfilled. And she goes to her father-in-law and says, hey, my biological clock is ticking. What you going to do? And Judah says, well, I'm kind of running out of sons, and the next one's much too young. So Tamar, being a bright lady, goes off and disguises herself as a hooker, and the Bible says harlot, and sets up business on the side of the road and seduces Judah. And he knows her, and doesn't recognize her, but knows her. And she extracts for payment a signet and a cord. When it turns out, and he does not recognize her, when it turns out that she's pregnant, and he finds out, your daughter-in-law is pregnant, he goes, well, that hussy, we're going to have her killed. It's going to be an honor killing. And she comes up to Judah and she says, hey, Jude, that ties into Here Comes the Sun later. Hey, Jude, you notice the signet? And he goes, boo. And he does the right thing. He does the honorable thing. He doesn't say, I never had relations with that woman, Ms. Tamar. He says, oh, yeah, I knew her. Okay, yeah, cool. And there they are, Judah and Tamar. Are they punished for him having gone to a harlot? Are they punished for her having tricked and deceived her father-in-law, my husband. Are they punished? They are the great, great, great grandparents of David. David is the great, 23 times more, grandparent of Joseph, stepfather of Jesus. So no, they're not punished. And as a matter of fact, we are in a temple, I noticed, that is, what's the religion here? Judaism. Judahism. It's not Davidism. It's not Josephism, which would actually make the most sense. And it's not Mosesism. It's Judaism, coming from a flawed but essentially honest person who, with all of his lusts and problems, did the right thing in the end, leading to David, a conspicuously flawed person who exemplified all of the problems with lust and sexuality that gave birth to Solomon, whose book Song of Songs is one of the earthiest and raciest books ever written, singing the praises of many activities that are forbidden or seem to be forbidden in Leviticus and Deuteronomy. All of this is to say that the issues of fertility and sex and sexuality and of human impulses have been of ancient concerns. They seem no more regulated today than they were regulated 2,000 years ago or 5,000 years ago, despite the interests of religion and society. The lusts are, in effect, the snake in the garden. There was a misleading part of the title, which was the title. You can't drive the snakes out of the garden, because as long as there's a human being in the garden, there are going to be those snakes. You can't run from the garden, because you're taking humanity with you. When you look at the story of St. Patrick, it's a story of not driving physical snakes away. It's a story about driving sin away in the symbol of that unbridled sexuality, which was the snake. Irish, and of course you knew that this week this was the St. Patty's tie-in, you know, that St. Patty's Day celebrates the driving away of the snakes. And the Irish whiskey guarantees you'll still see the snakes after a couple of glasses. Just a wee drum or two. I moved it to Scotland for a second. So the great religious question that every age and every time and every human being deals with is, when you're dealing in areas of sex and sexuality, are you talking about sin or sacrament? And the answer is yes. Context is everything. Sexuality is sung of and celebrated, and it is a sacramental act. Within the framework of Judaism, it's the one thing you're allowed to do other than pray on the Sabbath. You can't cook, you can't work, you can't make a fire except a fire of passion. It's a sacrament, it's not a sin. Out of the context of those relationships, and out of the context of the greater good of the tribe, it becomes the wild card in everybody's life that threatens community and family and stability, and always will. Religions, like families, want to take positions and say, this is right, this is wrong, because it's so much more difficult to deal with the complexities of what are the needs of people and of communities, of families, and of tribes. What are the agreements amongst human beings about how we will be together? What it means to love one another? What it means to know one another? And what is intimacy? Our society, as every society, is involved in trying to make simple rules out of complex relationships. One of the things that I certainly never envisioned when I was young and starting out was having issues of cyber fidelity, because the word cyber didn't exist when I was young and starting out. And the question is, well, if you can commit adultery in your heart, can you commit it on the net, even if you've never seen the other person, and the other person turns out not to be the hot 15-year-old that's advertising, but an 87-year-old guy without any hair and outweighing Sidney Greenstreet and Orson Welles put together. And so what are the natures of those relationships? What's the nature of the knowledge of each other? What's the nature of how we love one another and make intimate contact without using and abusing and diminishing the other? Those are the difficult questions. Now, it's true that fertility is also a difficult question in an era of unequal birth and lots of complexities around issues of population and how much the planet can bear and how much we can afford. But it is the human heart that is the wildest of wild cards. And society can do its best to try to tame that heart, but it hasn't done it successfully. And I think it probably shouldn't, because the issue does become individual, personal responsibility towards the full humanity of all of those whom we love. Simple answers, like one simple wedding ceremony or contract, doesn't cover all of the cases. When you look at the history of humanity, and you can see much of it in the history of biblical and religious thought, you see with the difficulties and the contradictions and the complexities and the love and the hate and the fear that go into how it is that we conduct the intimate connections that make family possible and that make our lives deep and rich and lead towards fulfillment. Guilt, sin, fear, punishment, disease have stopped almost no one. Care, consideration, a contract, an understanding of one's own values, that's a place where we start to take responsibility for the intimate connections that make family, community, society deep, rich, and rewarding.